This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, I have a very exciting day today, and I am not going to have any commercials because I am giving the entire hour to my very special guest, Margaret George. And I just want to thank, before I start with Margaret, I want to thank Glenn Erickson, one of my sponsors, who is also a great promoter of Toastmasters. And I want to thank him so much. And I also want to thank Bill Larson of Larson & Larson. He is my intellectual property lawyer, and he is just fantastic. As everyone knows, he comes on once a month to answer your intellectual property questions. He will be here next Thursday, and please send in your questions because he always loves to hear from you and answer your, just help you stop worrying about all the legal problems that you might face. And so it's just wonderful that Bill will be here in the studio with me next week. But meanwhile, if you need to contact him, his telephone number is 727-546-0660. And Larson & Larson is a premier intellectual property group. They are can handle people from all over the country, so just feel free to call him, and he would love to talk to you. Now I'm turning to my guest. As I said, I want to devote the entire hour to this guest because she is so wonderful, and I am just so honored to know her and to promote a book that actually was published in 1986. Margaret George is one of my absolute favorite authors. Margaret, so nice that you could join me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Wow.
I'm so happy to be here, there, with you.
Well, I hope that someday you take a vacation down here to glorious Clearwater, Florida, and you can come in the studio with me.
That would be great.
Because it was fun that I came up and had the opportunity to meet you in Madison, and you were so gracious, and it was just wonderful. Of course, it was wintertime, and I hope that you've gone through a hot winter summer. How's it now? Turning into fall?
It's very, very, it's beautiful. It's the way it's supposed to be in Wisconsin in the summer.
Because you had some rough days.
We've been having in August, but we didn't have it in July.
Well, Margaret, as I said, I one of the joys of having my own radio program, and I'm not beholden to anyone, I can review any book I want. And if the author is around, I can have them on because this book, as I said, it was published in 1986. It's the autobiography of Henry VIII. I think it is a brilliant book, and I just want to devote this hour. I'm really going to be turning it over to you mostly so that we can talk about this fantastic book.
Well, you had some very good questions that you put to me. You know, you kind of sent it in an email that made me think about things, and, you know, so I think you should help guide this.
Oh, I will. I will.
Reading it. It's been a long time since I wrote it.
Well, you know, a couple of things. First of all, I've got the book here in my hand. it means I'm very strong. And I'm holding it up to the camera because we are also on YouTube. It's a big book. And
yes.
It's so funny. It is 632 pages. And it's a hefty book. And you wrote this by hand, you know?
Yes, I did. Yes, yes. I started writing that book. It took me a long time to write it, but I wrote it on a yellow special three-hole punch, yellow lined, wide lined notepaper, you know, for like a college notebook kind of thing. And then I would laboriously, when I first started, I had one of those IBM correcting Selectric typewriters that were really the state of the art at the time, but that meant that I was always typing over again what I had already written. So it made the whole process really long, but I didn't see any other way to do it. I really couldn't. I never had written on a typewriter. You know, I had just written. I mean, back in college and all that, people didn't really necessarily have portable typewriters and things. So I still feel that probably you think better if your hand is connected to the pen and you're writing on, directly from your brain. But yeah, it made it a very long process.
Well, it's actually, I wanted to mention that because I want it to be an inspiration to all those authors out there, because I get authors. I was at a writer's meeting and someone came up to me and said, well, now I can write my book. I just got my computer. And I, you've been waiting 20 years for that computer. I mean, get real. I said, you can write your book by hand. And many authors do, because they have that sort of brain to feeling in your hand connection. Douglas Brunt wrote all of his books on legal paper, but then he's a yellow legal paper. He's in airports, and he said, I didn't need to wait until I got someplace where I could use a computer. So
yeah, that's true. Our, I think typewriters were even more clumsy because they didn't really offer much advantage over writing by hand, and that's all that the only other alternative.
And particularly the Selectric, which was very, it was annoying.
Yeah.
It was annoying.
Yeah, and you could decide whether it was a Pica or a Lees and all that. But I think that, of course, computers now make it so that you can, it's reproducible. That's the thing. I mean, typewriters, I remember people had to have carbon copies of things, and you still had to mail manuscripts back and forth and have them, have them insured and everything. Well, I'll just tell you one thing. I don't want to get off on the mechanics, but Henry is an example. I still have all the stages of it where, I have the handwritten stuff. I have the typewritten. And written out, and then I have the galley proofs, and each of those stages, the galley proofs, they were corrected by hand by me and my editor, and there was only one copy of it. So to get it back and forth safely was kind of a nail biting time. I mean, you could insure it, and you could do all these things with it, but if it disappeared, that was your only copy of it. So I do think the digital copies have kind of spared us from that fear. And electronic editing is actually easier than doing it with all the zillions of little notes pasted on and two colored pencils. You have the red pencil and your editor has the blue pencil, and so the process is easier now, but I don't think that makes much difference for the creative process, but the original material that you generate out of your head.
Well, I think it will make a difference to people in the future, because those writers like you who have these various versions along the way, the originals are actually very valuable now, because so many people, everything's written on the computer. You never see the changes. You never see the corrections. And I think one of the fascinating things, when PhD students are doing a thesis on an author. Of course, so many people, if I hear of one more who is going to do F. Scott Fitzgerald, I'll go crazy. They all go to Princeton and they want to see the original, his original documents. But it's a wonderful source, and I'm sure that it's fascinating to see the original and then the changes along the way.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, so that's the process, is that Henry was the most complete one. And I'll only say one more thing about the process and the computers. Around 1984, the first computers came in that I got, which was a rainbow, the digital rainbow, and the printer was one of those tractor feed things. But anyway, it really was time consuming to have to first write it by hand and then copy it on the computer. So I was doing Mary Queen of Scots, which was my next book after that, and I had a deadline, and it was due at a certain time, and I had written to a certain point, and I just looked at that deadline, and I said, could you are you going to be able to finish this in time? And I said, no. And then I had to ask myself the question, if you wrote it directly on the computer and you could skip the copying part, could you finish it on time? And the answer is yes, because you're cutting out that whole, it almost doubles the time to write it by hand and then type it out. So I said, well, then you know what you have to do. I'll tell you that I think it's on page 444 of Mary Queen of Scots is where I started writing directly on the computer. I took a really easy scene that was mainly someone receiving a letter, of which I already had the text of the letter. So it was as easy a scene as you could start with. But it was very awkward at first. But I think it certainly time-wise, you know, it really does save that entire step. So that's all I'm going to say about the process. But you can look at page 441 and Mary, and you can see if you see a difference in the way the writing went.
Okay. Well, see, that all of this is fun to know. It's history, and I love history. I love knowing all these little details. And, of course, you are, for whatever you wrote down, you wrote the book, you also had to take notes on the massive amount of research you did for this book.
That's right. Well, that's all still handwritten. I still write that on, you know, 4x6 cards and write. I do not do any of that on the computer.
So for Henry, we're going to talk about Henry, but let's stop for a minute and talk about this research. First, where you got the idea to make it an autobiography? Because it was the first, and the thing is, it's almost, once somebody reads this book, and I want to say it is, you know, over 600 pages, and so people will say, oh, that's too much, and even, you know, agents today would not even look at it. They'd like, forget it, you know, most of the time. But the thing is, people love series, and if you actually take, you know, four books in a series, it's going to be more than 600 pages. So they shouldn't get frightened that it's a big book. It has everything that you want in here. I was thinking, would I cut anything out of this book to make it, you know, if a publisher came along and said, cut this or cut this, I'd say, absolutely, you can cut one word out of this book. It's so perfect.
Well, thank you. Well, I felt that, you know, I wanted to tell his whole life. And I really do believe that, you know, in order to understand the adult, you've got to know what their childhood was like. You've got to know where they came from. So right away, you're going to get a whole biography. And also, in Henry's case, I mean, you really have, basically, you have seven other books with all the main characters in his life. I know Alison Weir is doing a series now, you know, one book per wife. There have been a number of those. So, and then you've got a factor Thomas More in there, so that makes seven. So, and then you've got, so no wonder it was long. And I think if you take it by that, it wasn't that long for each one of them. But I think you have to have his whole story, because otherwise, when you get to each part, you're going to have explain how it got there anyway. So, and I do think childhood is interesting, because you just can't imagine some famous people being children. You know, once upon a time, they were little kids, and they were 8 years old, 9 years old.
And his childhood is absolutely fascinating. Let's go there, because one of the things, of course, it is important to know that it wasn't expected that he was going to be the king, and he was being groomed for something else, which later on played a big part of how he thought. So tell us a little bit about where he came from.
So his father, Henry the VII, you know, he too had the heir and the spare, and the heir was Arthur, who was Henry's older brother, and so Henry was kind of, what do you do with the second son? Well, the church was, of course, this was before the Reformation. Henry was born about 20 years before Martin Luther ever came on the scene with his 95 Theses, and so the church was the second most powerful institution. In fact, sometimes it was more powerful than the crown. So you put your second son in the church. And I mean, he doesn't start out as a parish priest administering to the poor. He's going to start out you know, really high up. So the idea was that Henry would become, you know, a Archbishop of Canterbury, probably. And Henry kind of took to this because there was a real strain in him of piety. Now, we can laugh about this, people, but he really, he knew a lot about theology, and he wrote, he was appalled by Martin Luther, and so he wrote a thesis in defense of the seven sacraments, and the Pope, that's where Henry got that title, the Defender of the Faith, because the Pope was so pleased with Henry's orthodoxy. This is after Henry was already king, that he awarded him this title. So part of it really, you know, sunk into Henry, and he took it seriously. And that also, so that when he did finally have to leave Rome for his own personal reasons, he made sure that his church, it was really pretty, it was like Catholic. I mean, it was like Catholicism without the Pope. You know, and that's why even to this day the Church of England is the most, you know, high church, the Protestant church that's the most Catholic, at least in its trappings. So, yeah, it had a big effect on Henry, and it also made him feel that he was an expert in theology, so that when he began to doubt his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, it was legal because she had been married to his brother, and there are two contradictory passages in the Bible. One says it's a terrible thing if you marry your brother's wife, and you'll be doomed and be childless. And the other one says, no, it's your duty to marry your brother's wife. So the Pope had ruled, oh, it's okay, you can marry Catherine, I give my permission, it's all right. But when Henry began to doubt that, he began to question whether the Pope even had the ability to decide this, and he thought the Pope was wrong. And had he not had all that theological background himself, he probably wouldn't have dared to really, in his mind, be convinced that the Pope was just dead wrong, and therefore he was going to ignore the Pope. So, anyway, he even said, I will declare the Pope a heretic and do as I please.
Well, I think actually any other prince who might have come along, if they didn't have this religious education, if they didn't, in his case, of course, he was very bright. I mean, he was very intelligent. In his, you know, people have this image of him being just an old lecher or something. But you know, that's not what he was. I mean, he was as a young boy, he was very bright. He was very strong. He was very athletic. He had so many wonderful qualities. And of course, knowing religion and being able to sort of keep up to a great extent with the church people at the time was one of the reasons that he was able to to break with Rome.
Well, that's true, so it did stand him in good stead. And I think I had a line in Henry about no education is ever wasted, and for some reason that was my editor's favorite line in the whole book. It had to do with the religious education that he had. No education is ever wasted. So, yeah, but I think he did not see himself as a hypocrite in considering himself to be a religious man and being horrified by you know, Martin Luther and the Protestants.
Of course, you know, it's this wedding to his brother's widow, to Catherine, who... unfortunately, they lost one child after another, except for the only surviving child they had was Mary, who, of course, now we know through history as Bloody Mary. But, you know, there are so many things. One of the reasons I want to encourage people to read this book, there are so many things that you put in perspective that, you know, history is it's good for the mind. Anyone out there, you hear these things, you hear, or you go out to a Sunday brunch and somebody says, I want a Bloody Mary, but you don't know anything. You know, you don't know anything. And it's so nice when you actually know something, you can sit there and you can give a whole lecture. You know, people can read this book and at Sunday brunch, they can give a whole lecture about Mary. And it's just fun. History is so much fun to know.
Yes, it is. Well, you know, when you see, as you said, the background from which Mary came, in which she saw that her mother had been greatly wronged, she felt, and then Henry deserting the Catholic Church, and, you know, he had committed a great sin. And so you could see why she became this real zealous to restore the Catholic Church and to undo the things that her father had done. And, she went overboard with persecuting the Protestants. So, but you can really see, you know, it's not as simple as we remember things. But one thing I did want to talk about with you is about some of the research that I've done and play. I think, you know, you can read a lot in books, but I think going to the places where they, you know, where pivotal things happened in their lives is really important. And it was easier for me, you see, to do this in the, you know, the late 70s, before everything got so mechanized and touristed. And even back then, you know, Hampton Court was a nice place, but you had to go. You had to go in the winter, and I went in the winter one time where there was nobody around, and then I could sit in the Chapel Royal where Henry had spent time and, you know, really feel his presence. But there are a couple of places I went that I really wanted to share with your listeners, and that is, first of all, for the young Henry, who, you know, I was just in love with the young Henry. It's like you said, he was really something very, very special. And he became king when he was just 17. But the young Henry and how he was brought up, there was a place called Eltham Palace. It's outside of London. It's near Greenwich. And at the time that I went to see it, I wanted to go see it because I knew it had a great hall. It had one of the best great halls in England. And it was also the place where the court would keep Christmas. And so that was in the great hall that Henry first met his first mistress, Bessie Blunt. also, it was where he spent a lot of his childhood, because that's where the royal family was kind of like the relaxing place. So when I went to it, it was like it was part of the military had it. It was the British Army. And it was not a tourist place at all. And I had to walk to it, and I walked for ages, and I had a big map, you know, long before GPSs, and I came upon this place, and it was really magical. There were even swans in the moat, and I wasn't supposed to be in there. It was really off-limits to public, but I got in there anyway, and that's also part of the fun of some of this research. You go a lot of places you're not supposed to, and it becomes a kind of a challenge to see if you can even get in there. So they were decorating, actually, they were going to have an event there, you know, just like the parties that Henry used to have. And I really felt the young Henry there very, very much. Well, now I just looked it up before our talk, and of course now it's been all touristized, and they have all these events, and they're also mainly showing the 1930s house that was built next to it. So it gets harder and harder, I think, to evoke these places. You know,
and they probably have a rock concert there, so...
Do, and you know, I couldn't even find out whether the Great Hall was even open to the public anymore. You know, that's really what I was interested in seeing. But I will say one of the other websites I left this up on so that I could read it to you all, because I think it's really true, about Eltham Palace. They talk medieval Eltham. The medieval part of Eltham Palace is quite stunning for those who are interested in that era. The Great Hall of Eltham Palace is still extant. It was originally built for the Yorkist King Edward IV in the 1470s, and his grandson, Henry VIII, spent much of his childhood here. It is so atmospheric that you can almost see their ghosts walking its floors. This is the only part of the medieval Eltham Palace which still exists. So I don't know, you know, if you have to get special permission to go in there, but that really described it very well. So I think when you do things like that, you feel you kind of have this bond with the character, and you feel that you're now, you have the credits to write about him and have a scene set in that place. So the other place that I went to was where the last, that I would recommend, I mean, I went to a lot of places, was Catherine of Aragon's last place that Henry sent her when they were separated and he married Anne Boleyn, because she insisted on saying she was still queen. She refused to you know, step aside. So she died there in 1536. And there was supposed to be a ghost there too, her ghost. But it's now, it was a ghoul when I had to write to the headmaster and see if I could get permission to go there. But she had lived in a series of apartments there, and she would not let anybody wait on her who wouldn't call her the queen. She would not take the lesser title that Henry wanted to give her. And when she died, she wrote this letter to Henry. I mean, well, before she died. And she ended it by saying, "Lastly, I make this vow that mine eyes desire you above all things." And, you know, she was really in love with him. And I think for her to be that much in love with him, he had to have good qualities. I mean, she was a very stern judge of character, but she obviously loved him. If after all he had done to her, you know, that was her last word, her last words to him. But going there was interesting because it was, you know, the building was still intact. And as far as where the ghost walked, they claim that they hear footsteps in a certain room, and the ceiling has been lowered and so on and so on. Anyway, I like ghost stories, so I like
so do I. Usually at the bottom of the hour, I take a commercial break. But as I said, I'm not going to take a commercial break. But I am going to play something for you that I think you will enjoy. So just listen to this, and then we'll be right back.
This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz, The Splendor Before the Dark, a novel of the Emperor Nero by author Margaret George. Need I say more? Here's the buzz. With the beautiful and cunning Poppaea at his side, Nero Augustus commands the Roman Empire, ushering in an unprecedented era of artistic and cultural splendor. Although he has yet to produce an heir, his power is unquestioned. But in the 10th year of his reign, a terrifying prophecy comes to pass, and a fire engulfs Rome, reducing entire swaths of the city to rubble. Rumors of Nero's complicity in the blaze start to sow unrest among the populace and the politicians. Nero will either survive and be the first in his family to escape the web of betrayals, that is, the Roman court, or be ensnared and remembered as the last radiance of the greatest dynasty the world had ever known. Margaret George weaves a web of politics and passion as ancient Rome's most infamous emperor cements his place in history in The Splendor Before the Dark. Margaret George specializes in epic fictional biographies of historical figures, takes pains to make them as factually accurate as possible without compromising the drama. This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper. For more on my suggestions, series you should not miss, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com. And click on Book Buzz. That's radio-joyonpaper. Rita Moreau, buzzing off for now.
Okay.
Well, that's a nice surprise. What fun.
Well, I do these. Actually, Rita Moreau, who is a contributor here on Joy on Paper, she does these reviews of books, of the books that we love. And I play them quite often. So I've already played this commercial for you. I've played it maybe a half dozen times already. And I will play it over and over because this is one of the problems with the market, the book market, and is that so often an author writes a book, you get publicity on the release date and for maybe a month or two afterwards, and then it's forgotten and nobody comes back and interviews the author again. And so I like to do these reminders. I do them for, I do them for David Baldacci. I do them for Karen Slaughter, who's going to be on the program next week, for Tasha Alexander, who is one of my favorite authors, also because her books are set in England in Victorian times. So I wanted to play this, and Rita Moreau really enjoys doing these, and I thought, you know, it's something that we can do to just help keep your name out there. And
well, very, very much. I really appreciate it, and it's fun to hear it. One thing, before we get back to Henry, as you mentioned Nero, I did want to say I don't know if Juliet Gray, when you spoke to her about Versailles and her things that she does about this thing that we are going to be doing, some authors It's a new idea, and it's called edutainment. Now, this is kind of experimental, but what it really is authors, both fiction and nonfiction, will do what is like an audio guide of a historic site, except, I mean, we're going to write the script. We're not going to do the speaking, except it will center on a person, so that, like, I am doing the Circus Maximus, and it's going to be about the assassination attempt on Nero there. So, but it will also guide people. You know, you put on these earphones and you walk around and say, now we're going down the path, and this is where the plebeian stood, and this is where the chariots came out. And it should be so that you get, they think that stories, this is why I'm telling you this now, because we're talking about historical fiction and stories, but we learn history because of the stories of the people who lived in. You know, we learn about something, not just a building, but what happened in that building to those people, to some people. And so this is just an idea, thinking that rather than concentrate on the architecture and the setting and the history of chariot racing and all that, would it be more interesting to see the Circus Maximus through a certain event.
I love the idea, because this is exactly what I say, that when you start reading biographies, autobiographies in this case, you really do get into the personality of the person, and you start understanding more about why this building is here, why why you have a Bloody Mary in your hand on a Sunday morning. All of this stuff is just wonderful. You know, we have all these brain cells, and it is so wonderful if we can fill them up with interesting things, instead of, so often, you know, people are like, they're just not doing anything, and it's just wonderful. I want to encourage people to read history, and I do want to take a minute to for you to say hi to really one of your favorite a fan who loves your book so much, and that's Mickey. And you were kind enough to send her an autograph photograph before, so just say hi to her.
Yeah, well, hi, Mickey. How are you doing?
Okay, well, she's doing well, and I'm so happy that she's going to be here next week also. And I know that she loves your books. We were talking about the two Nero books, which were The Confessions of Young Nero, and then The Splendor Before the Dark. She enjoyed those, and as a matter of fact, one of her favorites, in addition to Henry VIII, is the one about Mary Queen of Scots. Yeah, she loves Mary Queen of Scots. So after we're going to do another one of these 1 hour deals where we will talk about a specific book. Okay.
Okay, great. No, it'd be fun to talk about Mary Queen of Scots. It's gotten a lot of new attention since that movie came out.
Yeah.
You know, which has made people remember that there is a Mary Queen of Scots and be interested in learning more about her.
Well, you know, on Henry VIII, now we have to talk about the most, you know, important thing that happened in his life, is Anne Boleyn.
And yes.
When we look back in history, I've been wondering, I don't know if anybody has yet written a book about it or done a thesis about how America would be so different if Anne Boleyn hadn't come into Henry's life. If England had remained Catholic, I believe America would not have been the same, because it was the people who came to America who were already, you know, ready for changes. The British people had accepted changing the church. So when they got to America, they were ready to change the government. So tell us about Anne Boleyn. What was she? How did she get him? I mean, he waited 7 years to marry this woman.
I don't know if anybody can really figure out what it was about her. She certainly had a fatal kind of charm, not just for Henry, but, you know, she had a number of people that were smitten with her. Our portraits, of course, give us no idea, really. They don't capture what, maybe not even what she really looked like, but obviously whatever there was about her isn't going to be captured in a picture. And most of what was written about her is written by her enemies. So it's a lot like Cleopatra, where you hear about Cleopatra, but through the eyes of the Romans. And so, you know, there were, after her fall, of course, you know, even the people that had purported to be her friends turned against her. I think she did have a way of also alienating people. I mean, she was, could be charming on one hand and then alienate people on the other. And also, though, I think she became very frightened when, and who knows what in the world, why Henry turned on her is much too simple to say, oh, she didn't give him an heir. I mean, and that's the great mystery to me is what in the world, I mean, he moved heaven and earth to be with this person. And he had been around her for 6 or 7 years, as you said. So like, what was it that all of a sudden, he turned against her suddenly. You know, it wasn't like, it was a gradual thing. It was like he kind of woke up one day and said, oh, you know, I don't want to be with this woman.
Well,
he's terrible. But you know, what, and the only thing I can think of is that, in my case anyway, because you are writing always from your own perspective, I would have to find out something about the person that so negated everything else I had ever known about them. I would have to find out, you know, I'd have to find out my husband was really a Nazi or something. And what did he find out about her or think he found out about her that would have sparked this in him? That's all I can,
well, you know. Because let's go back a little, explain. He, of course, he was married to Catherine. He had mistresses. One of them was Anne Boleyn's sister.
And the other was actually Anne Boleyn's sister, Mary Boleyn.
Now, none of them captivated him to the point where he really turned over the world. He actually turned over the world. And, you know, I have a connection to him in the fact that I bought a cottage. I think I mentioned to you, I bought a cottage in England, in Sonning, that had a priest hole underneath it. I didn't mean to buy the priest hole. I bought the cottage, and I was shocked to find a priest hole underneath it, which cost a lot of money. It was not fun, because the cottage was over 400 years old. So he went and he just ripped everything apart when it comes to religion in England for this woman.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and plus he had been such a devoted son of the church. And he also didn't change his mind easily. I mean, one of the ambassadors said about him, even an angel coming down from heaven, once he made up his mind, he didn't change it. So it must have been something as absolutely cataclysmic that made him change his mind so completely about Anne Boleyn.
Well, now the parties and the, for example, the her coronation and all of this, what you wrote in the book are fact?
Oh, well, she had a very fantastic coronation, and Henry did sit on the sidelines because it was her day. But you did ask me about the black and white ball and the opium parties. And no, that was fictional. But she was known for these extravagant entertainments, and she was also did encourage at one point all these kind of lovesick people to hang around and at her salons. So, you know, I was just trying to dramatize those two aspects that of her once she became queen. But the actual specifics, like the black and white ball, was something that I, you know, made up based on what I assumed that these parties were like.
Well, now this, of course, I want to mention the dates a little bit, because the Tudor period was from 1485 to 1603. So it wasn't that long of a period, actually. But Henry was known, unlike his father, who was very parsimonious and didn't want to spend money, Henry did enjoy having, you know, sumptuous affairs and gala festivals, and tell us a little bit about his meeting in France with the King of France.
Yeah, well, that became legendary because Henry was, as I said, he was a very young king. He became king when he was going to soon be 18, and he was good-looking and tall and bursting with youth. However, it wasn't too long after that until a Frenchman became king who was even younger than Henry and also became successful militarily. And poor Henry never was much of a soldier, although he wanted to be. So Henry was very jealous of Francis I, and they had this big rivalry. They died within a few months of each other, too, after... So they were going to have this big meeting in France, and it's been nicknamed called the Field of Cloth of Gold because everything was so sumptuous. They built a whole village for it, and the kings were, of course, decked out in all their glory. It was some ostensible political meeting, but really it was so they could take a measure of each other. And they had a little wrestling match, and Francis threw Henry on the ground. Henry was very angry. And, you know, it started out sort of a horseplay, but then Francis managed to throw him on the ground. And so Henry left there not particularly enamored, even less enamored of Francis. And also, at that point, Catherine had her last child, and already the succession was starting to be a problem. Mary was 5 years old, and there were no children born. There were none after her that lived anyway. And so when Henry took Catherine with him to the Field of Cloth of Gold, Francis said, "The King of England is young and handsome, but his wife is old and withered up," or something like that. And of course, you know, she was older than Henry. And he was making an observation that probably encapsulated, you know, the problems Henry was going to have. We were going to see her as old. She was not able to have any more children. And, yeah, the king is young and vigorous, but his wife is old and decrepit. So that was the Field of Cloth of Gold. It gave us those two great moments about the wrestling match and then the comment that turned out to be very predictive about Catherine and Henry.
Did you ever visit that location?
No, I never have.
You didn't? Okay. When we were in Europe, you know, as I said, I lived in England for quite a few years, and we used to drive all the time down to, we'd take the ferry and we'd take our car and go across to France. Almost every other weekend we used to go to Paris. And so we did take that little side trip to the area where this event took place. And of course it's very plain, very, you know, countryside, which it was at that time, so nothing changed. And it's fun to sort of imagine what it looked like, because your descriptions are very good, and there are it's fascinating to think of how they, you know, designed it and brought all these people, the entire courts, together.
Yeah, well, I'm glad it's still countryside. I was afraid you were going to say it has a gigantic Walmart on it.
Well, it was countryside when I was there in the 80s. I don't know. You never know. That it could happen. You know, that's as you said, it is so much fun to visit these locations. You know, people go on these trips and they're not always sure what they're doing. They just go. They want to go. But it's so much more fun if you read beforehand, if you read a book like this. And I want to tell people, you know, don't be afraid to read the hardback book, but it is available in Kindle, and
yep.
And it's also, I would do, if I was anyone out there today, I would do the Kindle and the Audible. The Audible book is absolutely fantastic. I love the narrator, John Case. When you listen to this book on the Audible, you feel like you're listening to Henry. And of course, tell us about how you did it with his jester. What's the format for writing the book?
You know, I thought it would be a good idea to have someone who knew Henry, you know, comment on him occasionally, like, you know, annotate things. And I had to think hard. Had to be somebody that outlived him, because I wanted them to, I mean, how else can you describe his funeral?
Yeah, exactly.
How else can you describe what happened afterward? And I think that's always important. And there was really nobody that had known him all his life closely who outlived him. But the jester was, he actually had this kind of relationship with him, and he you know, there are portraits of them together. And apparently he was close enough to him that he would be painted with him. And also that apparently he stopped being the public entertainment jester and just became Henry's private jester. And but he did not join the court until around the time of the Field of Cloth of Gold. So the whole childhood part, Will Summers isn't going to know about or be able to comment on. He can only comment on what people told him. But anyway, they did have this very close relationship. And maybe it's the one person that Henry really trusted who didn't let him down. He kind of fades out of history after he went to Elizabeth's coronation, and then after that he kind of fades out of history, so we don't know what happened to him after that. There are engravings of him, too. So he was a true historical character who actually fit perfectly in the for the narration of the book.
Well, speaking of Elizabeth, of course, we have to do Elizabeth. I think we'll do Elizabeth next, and and then we'll do Mary Queen of Scots. So I want you to come back, and we'll do each of those. Will be a one-hour program, so you can talk more in depth, and we'll explain more about how you write and about the fantastic books, because they're all great. And I'm so honored just to know you, and I know that my son was so thrilled to meet you a couple of times now, and he is just blown away as a young person. He had not known too much about you know, Henry VIII in detail, as I had already read like 40 books about Henry before I read your book. So. So it was really wonderful how he got into it and is now deeply into history. So I'm glad that you've really, you know, opened up a whole world for him on this. Although we homeschooled, you know, we didn't cover as much of this British history as I wanted, and so now he's thrilled with it. And I think everyone, and I know Mickey Larson and all of these people who are your fans, love your books, and we want to encourage other people to get your books. I would start with Henry VIII, and then we'll go to the other books. And Margaret George, I think you are brilliant, and I think my own feeling when I'm reading it, and as I reread, I've read it now three times, and there I'm marking sections, and when I see the quality of the writing, I say, "Wow, this is Pulitzer Prize winning writing," because very few people can achieve what you've achieved.
Oh wow! Thank you very, very much. I appreciate it. And you know, I think one of the good things about historical novels is if they're well written, and they can really help get people into history, because again, we like stories and we like to have the drama. I mean, that's why Shakespeare's history plays are so popular, one of his most popular plays, because he makes it easy for you to get into the history.
Exactly. Well, Margaret George, just mention your website.
Yes, it's www.margaretgeorge.com.
So that's easy. Everybody can go there and find out more and find out about Margaret's tortoise. How's Troilus doing?
Well, listen, we just had our 37th anniversary of taking Troilus home with us. That was 2 days ago.
Oh, wow.
August. So he's very happy because he gets to go outside now that it's nice weather, and he gets to go to his garden. And, this is his favorite time of year, of course.
Okay. Well, again, thank you so much for being my very, very special guest here on Joy on Paper today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay.
And well, I love talking to you.
Thank you. And I'll set up some dates for you to come back on the show. Okay?
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Okay, everybody, really, you know, I think if you have any interest in history, taking this book and combining with the Kindle and the Audible version, you will find yourself absolutely enthralled. It is, her writing is so good, and I forgot to mention something she wrote that sort of stuck in my mind. And I wasn't sure, you know, about. I always look for quotes about joy, and one of the quotes that she has, and this is from her book, is "Joy sticks in the memory, bright and burnished, leaping out across the years. It is a thing pure in itself, joy, and the rarest of traits among men." So. It gave me a great deal of joy to talk to her, a great deal of joy to meet her, and to meet her tortoise, who is quite, my goodness, I think the tortoise is actually like 55 years old. So it was a thrill to have her on the program today, and I will have her back for Mary Queen of Scots, for Elizabeth I. By the way, Elizabeth II is directly, you know, or related all the way back to 1066, to William the Conqueror, who conquered England, and of course is related to Elizabeth I. So they're all connected. It's an amazing long line of royal family, and it's fascinating. And I want to talk next time. I forgot to mention about where Henry VIII was buried, and he was buried in Windsor, where we just experienced the Meghan Markle and Harry wedding. And so there's so many fascinating things, and you can read more about it in this book. It's called The Autobiography of Henry VIII. It's a beautiful book, and I hope that you will get it. And just remember, one of the things I always tell everyone, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, to hear them in an audible book, or if you're really lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into streaming video, a major motion picture, or perhaps on the Hallmark Channel. Or if it's one of those books about four neighbors, I get so many books about four neighbors, maybe on Lifetime Television, because I'm getting a lot of books about neighbors, scary neighbors. But you never know. All you have to do is start writing. Remember, a page a day, and in a year, you will have a novel. Meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. He's saluting me. I'm saluting him. Bye-bye now. Have a great weekend. We'll be right back.